Welcome to a podcast of Beyond the Book, a presentation of the not-for-profit Copyright Clearance Center. Copyright Clearance Center is the world's largest provider of copyright compliance solutions through a wide range of innovative licensing services and comprehensive educational programs for authors, publishers, and their audiences in academia, business, and research institutions. For more information about Beyond the Book and Copyright Clearance Center, please go to www.beyondthebook.com.
Good evening and welcome to Cambridge Forum, where we are discussing the American landscape, risky writing, and the forces keeping it silent. I'm Richard Hoffman, a member of the Penn New England Executive Board and its Freedom to Write Committee. Let me first introduce our panelists, and then we'll move right into our discussion of the forces at work in writing and publishing that attempt to maintain a kind of landscape, keeping us all reading what is inconsequential. Mark Pavlik is co-editor and publisher of Brooklyn-based Hanging Loose Press, one of the country's oldest independent literary publishers. There he first published Sherman Alexie, Kimiko Han, and Kathy Park Hong, among others. He has edited numerous anthologies, including Present Tense, Poets in the World, and Shooting the Rat, drawn from the legendary high school section of Hanging Loose magazine. Mark is the author of five collections of his own poems, the most recent of which is Official Versions. He supports his poetry habit by teaching mathematics at the University of Massachusetts in Boston. Poet Linda McCarriston has written three books of poems, including Eva Mary, winner of the Terence DePré Award and finalist for the National Book Award in 1991. Her current project is a collection of prose pieces called Class Colored Glasses. Linda has taught in the MFA program at the University of Alaska Anchorage since 1994. Jill Petty has worked in independent publishing for more than 15 years, serving on the editorial staffs of New Art Examiner, The Nation, and Ms. Magazine. Most recently, she was an editor-publisher at South End Press. The 30-year-old nonprofit, collectively run book publisher based in Cambridge. She also teaches workshops and courses on publishing and literature. Carol Horn is general manager of Harvard Bookstore, an independent bookstore here in Cambridge, Massachusetts. Active in the book-selling community since 1974, she has served on the board of directors of the American Booksellers Association, the Independent Booksellers Association, and the New England Booksellers Association. Through her teaching and writing, she's worked to train new generations of booksellers, and through her service on literary prize juries and grant committees, she has helped nourish writers and small presses. Now, before we begin, please allow me as moderator to spill onto the table, as it were, a number of questions to get us all thinking. First of all, what do we mean by risky writing? Is there a prevailing orthodoxy that exerts pressure on writers and publishers to conform? How much of the difficulty facing American writers and publishers can be described as a signal noise problem in which the bad, or at least the inconsequential, drowns out the good? Pan American Center reports that only 3 or 4% of books published in the United States are translations, as opposed to 30% of books published in Europe. Is this cause for alarm? What might be done to widen our purview as readers to include a broader, truly global discourse? Can some of the current circumstances faced by independent publishers be traced to specific government policies or legislation, for example, tax law reform and postal increases? Now, of course, there's also the question of self-censorship. At a recent panel of international writers at Brown University, one man asked what an American writer might do to counter today's jingoism, militarism, and assaults on the Constitution. The Nigerian poet and playwright Wole Soyinka, who has been imprisoned on more than one occasion for his writings, responded that one might begin by waking each morning and asking, "What could I write today that would really get me in trouble?" Perhaps together we can address that question in the course of this evening's discussion as well. In any case, to start us off, I'd like to pose a general question to the members of our panel and ask each to address it in turn. The question is this. From your respective viewpoints as writers, teachers, editors, publisher, and bookseller, can you tell us, please, what forces you have seen at work that constrain American literary discourse and effectively censor writing that challenges the social, political, and aesthetic status quo? Let's go to our first panelist, Mark Pavlak. Welcome to Cambridge Forum, Mark.
Thank you very much, Richard. So I'm going to largely speak from my perspective right now and as a editor, publisher of poetry. I'm also a poet, and I frequently write political poems. In fact, I was pleased to hear that the award winner tonight, Dost, writes a lot of satirical poems, which is very close to my own heart. But of course, the irony here is that in a authoritarian or dictatorial regime, writing such poetry will land you in jail or in isolation or result in death or some such thing. Whereas here in America, you're sort of treated with irrelevance. And so that's sort of one of the ironies, I think, that we have to embrace here as poets in a free speech democracy. But let me return to the question of being a small press publisher of poetry. So if you think of the publishing world, conglomerate publishing, a very large circle, and then you reduce it to small independent publishing, a significant amount of which is nonfiction. And then you reduce it further to poetry, and so you're really narrowing this circle of interest to a very small one. And so already we're sort of at risk of having a very tiny audience. Small press publishers. So one of our functions at Hanging Loose, so as Richard said, we've been doing this for over 40 years. Our emphasis is on really discovering new voices and promoting the work of older writers who we feel deserve a wider audience neglected writers. One of the things I'm most proud about is that we publish astonishing high school writers. In every issue of our magazine, our 92nd issue is about to appear in the next couple of weeks. And every single issue, we've been publishing astonishing high school writers. And let me tell you, that's risky writing. And it's not only risky, but it's also writing that is incredibly accomplished. About a half a dozen of the kids, in quotes, who appeared in our high school section were selected for the best American poetry while they were high school kids. So it was pretty impressive in terms of quality. We, publish a good number of octogenarian writers. And so the other thing I think that the small literary press does is discover new writers, emerging writers, and I think it's not the only place, but it's a principal place where, risky, what we call risky or challenging writing emerges in small presses. And we're sort of a launching pad. So, yes, we launched Sherman Alexie's career. We published his very first book, a book of poems, The Business of Fancy Dancing. It's our bestseller, far outselling anything else we've ever sold. We continue to be his poetry publisher, but, he was picked up by a major publisher. We've launched, in essence, we published the first books of Kimiko Han, Kathy Park Hong, both of whom are now published by Norton. Dennis Nirksey, Dean Nirksey, who you'll see in the New Yorker appearing frequently, who's been picked up by Knopf. So I think this is one of the functions of the small press is to really find, risky, unorthodox, challenging writers and give them an opportunity to, first see publication, find an audience, and develop their talents to the point where they can really begin to find an audience. The other thing I would say about, so what challenges us? Well, economics is what challenges us. The economics of small press publishing, we do not take salaries at Hanging Loose. We all have our, you know, our other jobs, so I teach mathematics to support this habit. The profits we make, which are pretty tiny, get put back into publishing the next year's list of new emerging writers. And we live on the margins. And somehow, you know, it's miraculous, but somehow we've survived for over 40 years. But the economics of publishing and getting our books into stores. So we've discovered these writers. We've published their books. But how do we get them to an audience? I mean, I think that's really the challenge. We can't afford to, like big publishers, pay bookstores to prominently display our books at the very front of the store. We have a tiny, minuscule advertising budget. Small presses have distribution networks. We can't afford salespeople. So there are national distributors. There are two national distributors, essentially, for small presses, Consortium and Small Press Distribution. We're a little too small in our volume for Consortium. And I'm actually happy we never went with Consortium because a number of slightly larger literary presses that did were convinced that they should print larger runs of their books because Consortium was going to get them into major chain bookstores. And the result was they invested a lot of money, and about 80% of their books were returned a year later. So they invested all this money, and it led to really almost an economic collapse. And several presses actually folded as a result of this. Nevertheless, the economics are such that we probably make about on a $16 book sold in the bookstore, after the bookstore takes its discount, after the distributor takes its discount, we make less than a dollar per book. And we take that dollar and put it back into publishing next year's books. So economics really is what's, I think, is one of the principal things that is really threatening. And just like independent bookstores, which are also threatened by economic conditions. So, you know, the conditions of small press publishing and economics, I think, are a principal threat to the emergence of new, challenging, unorthodox writing.
Thank you, Mark. And now we'll hear from Linda McCarriston.
Thank you, Richard. I'm going to speak primarily as a teacher in a Master of Fine Arts in Creative Writing program, because I think that that phenomenon is very important today in making writers. It seems to me that almost everyone passes through either such a program or one of the summer writing programs or a writing conference. There's a network of Excuse me. I'm trying to remember the numbers from the Associated Writing Programs. It seems to me there are something like 40,000 writers and teachers enrolled now in writing programs throughout the United States in colleges and universities, and we are exporting these programs to other parts of the country, particularly connections that we've made with English-speaking countries, and even English-speaking countries which formerly have had an active intellectual left. And I like to think of our export of the creative writing programs as another form of capitalist monologue and a particular ideology regarding creative writing, and therefore the intellectual life. I've been thinking about these issues myself. Of course, I published Eva Mary in 1991, and it was at that time very transgressive and still is. And subsequent to that, I've written about class consciousness, or rather class unconsciousness, among American writers, using my own class unconsciousness as an example from which I required awakening. I mean, I grew up in Lynn, Massachusetts, didn't leave town till I was almost 30 years old, and basically spent my life trying to pretend I was perhaps from Nahant or Swampscott or Wellesley, any place but Lynn. And so I've been very aware, increasingly. I started teaching high school English in 1965 at Salem High School. And I've been in English classroom for a long time. And I have become aware that I deliver ideology. I can't resist knowing that anymore. I believe, with Michael Zweig, who teaches at Stony Brook, I believe, and who's running a conference called How Class Works this June, which Richard I and some other folks are going to be taking part in. 62% of us are, in fact, members of the working class. Americans don't know this. Americans believe that we are a great middle class with a teeny little frosting of the rich and a teeny little thin soul of the poor. But that's not us. And I really believe that teaching creative writing and teaching literature in general is a way of remaking potentially unsettling class consciousness in our students to be identified with where these students believe they are going. I believe that teaching creative writing is about helping students achieve upward mobility as well as having them learn to think as though they were already where they hope to be. And indeed, if they hope to get there, that's the way they're going to have to think to get there, and that's the way they're going to have to write. So that, in fact, what I teach, I believe very often, is I teach students to have an aesthetic victory over their own experience and insight, and to sound like someone they're not. And, of course, it's education in general is a double-edged sword. Of course, we all assimilate. My family is first generation Northern Irish on one side and French and Indian on the other. And the nuns taught me to stop saying ain't and to stop using the double negatives. And it all worked. But I did also learn to think. And over many years, I have felt increasingly the resistance of what it is I'm supposed to be doing to what it is I really believe I should be doing, which is liberating students not simply to careers or to aesthetic gestures, but to become wholly human, including socially, politically human. And as a creative writer, I've come to realize that there's a phenomenon that I call lyric triumphalism, the most profound and beneficent term that can be applied to any piece of writing these days. It's so lyric. It's lyric this and lyric that. People don't realize even what they are saying when they use that term. They think that they are using the term that describes the crown on the highest level, the highest genre of literary achievement, which is, of course, poetry. We all know that's a hierarchy. And the hierarchy within poetry is the lyric crown. What we don't realize is that traditionally, the lyric mode, the lyric posture of address, is one in which the poet is overheard by the audience. Figuratively speaking, the lyric poet's back is turned to the audience, and the audience eavesdrops. And, of course, all sorts of things are possible for the lyric poet in that position because of the absence of accountability to a readership, to an audience. But the other half of the human voice, the other half of poetry's mind, belongs in the old rhetorical camp, which is the bardic tradition, in which the poet turns and faces his or her audience and says, yes, we really are all here together. And yes, there really are important things for us to say and do. This lyric triumphalism, if you begin to listen for it and notice it, not only affects how we teach poetry, which is indeed a small world, it affects how we teach the memoir. What is lovelier than the new lyric essay, whatever that means? What is lovelier than the memoirs that turn out to be fraudulent, but which have that ring of truthiness? That sense that everyone in the workshop agrees that this rings true because everyone in the workshop has spent 15 years learning to think in a way that belies their experience and insight. The situation, the mechanics of this lyric monologue affect, color, and shape all of the other creative literary discourses in this country. And this is an almost unaddressable issue. I am a graduate of a Master of Fine Arts in Creative Writing program. I had excellent teachers. They taught me how to craft a poem. They taught me how to read, to learn to be a poet. They wanted me to have a career. I do have a career. I have the precious tenured position. I have been in trouble, as one of our audience members can vouch, in Alaska for my writing. I think I have been in trouble in Alaska for not being the poetess action figure that I was supposed to be, the Pied Piper of Silence, the woman in the black cape with a cigarette, seducing male and female, potentially dangerous citizens, into a life of pose and silence, into the literary quietism that we think is so venerable only in this country. This is the only country in which there really has not been a developed left historically, except for brief periods. And that fact is tremendously apparent in our poetry. I'd like to quote, before I hand the mic on, something from Harper's back in, I think, December or January. John Leonard, in his review, chose to write about Helen Vendler's new book on Yeats. I did my Master of Fine Arts thesis on Yeats and came to some different conclusions than Helen Vendler did. But what she was quoted by Vendler, by Leonard as saying is very important. It is Khrushchev rapping the table with his slipper. She says, "Poems are hypothetical sites of speculation, not position papers. They do not exist on the same plane as actual life. They are not votes. They are not uttered from a podium or a pulpit. They are not essays. They are products of reverie." They are indeed, but they have another half. Thank you.
Thank you, Linda. We'll move on to hear from Jill Petty.
Thank you, Richard. Scoot a little bit closer, maybe. I'm going to be speaking from my perspective as a former editor and publisher at South End Press. I see some colleagues in the room, and we are at South End Press. I had the luxury and challenge of working with editors whose job was to find writers who were going to push social movements forward. We were looking for writers marginalized by race, class, age, sexual preference, politics. You know, that was the purpose of the press, was to create dialogue around a lot of the issues that, you know, we're going to be talking about tonight. I'm also going to be talking from my perspective as a teacher and student of the history of the alternative press movement in this country, and as a woman of color who is a new parent, looking for writing that reflects my experience back to me, or reflects some of my experience back to me, and having a hard time finding that. And I've been meditating a lot about the article that was in the New York Times Book Review in July of this year by Martha Southgate, thinking about what is risky writing. Risky writing is, you can define it in a lot of ways. You could talk about the dearth of black literary fiction at this point as being classified as risky writing. You can talk about writings by political dissenters as risky. Talk about, writers marginalized for any number of reasons as risky. So I think I'm kind of thinking about the question of what is risky, who defines what is risky. And I'd have to agree with Mark as a publisher that the challenges to publishing risky writing are economic, certainly. They're also structural, because not only do you have to get the books into the stores, you need to get your books reviewed by presses, by newspapers, by magazines. And after working at a left press for several years, there are definite challenges to doing that beyond the challenge of not having enough not having enough money to do it, not having enough people power to do it. So there are a lot of hoops you have to jump through to get your message out there. And I think that I want to explore with other people on the panel the nature of what risky writing is, and as well as what does economic pressure look like? How do we break that down and talk about its many components? And how does that affect different writers and different audiences differently? And I'll stop.
Thank you, Jill. And Carol Horn.
Thank you. As a bookseller, I'm going to start with some of those nitty-gritty things that other people have mentioned, economics, sales, marketing, and the challenges of getting your books to break out into the marketplace. I've been in the book business for 30 years, and I have never seen a more unsettled time. I think that there are many, many challenges, difficulties, and what I would call minuses going on in the world that mitigate against risky writing making it into the marketplace. I would like to end, though, with a few things that I see as positive. But I'll start out on the minus side. First of all, there has been major consolidation throughout the publishing industry, from big box retailers who have put many independent bookstores out of business, to larger publishers who continue to buy up smaller publishers, and consolidation is rampant in the publishing world. And I think everybody knows that consolidation inevitably leads to homogenization. There is a signal-to-noise ratio. It is harder and harder to have things of quality and value get any attention, because there is so much that is trivial that gets so much of the attention. People are reading less, we're pretty sure. We're not positive. But we do know that books are competing for people's leisure time with an ever and ever expanding variety of things that take attention away from literature. There is certainly book sales have not grown in the past years as the population has grown, and probably book sales have actually declined. So there seems to be a lack of an audience, or growing, or a decreasing audience. The Nielsen Book Scan, which tracks sales of books, found that of all the books published, and they were tracking about 1.2 million books in 2004, that there were only 25,000 titles that sold 5,000 copies or more. And that was not just new books, but all the books in print that they were tracking. So not many titles that are really finding their place in the market. The government has certainly done things both on the national and state level that directly try to restrict or censor what is available. The U.S. Patriot Act, I think Eric mentioned as he was giving the award, but there are also things such as a new law in Indiana that would require all booksellers, anyone who sold books that had, quote, sexually explicit material included, to register with the state. Sexually explicit material is defined so broadly that practically any bookstore, maybe not Christian-only bookstores, but any regular bookstore would have to register with the state. This law was passed, and it was signed into law by the governor a couple of weeks ago. It will be challenged by the American Booksellers Foundation for Freedom of Expression and the American Library Association and others, but it seems that there are growing threats in this regard. In terms of subsidizing literary and small presses, the National Endowment for the Arts has become politicized, certainly in the last 7 years or so, much more than it has in the 30 years that I've been dealing with it, with literature. And as Eric expressed, we hope that this will end next year. But right now, it is a serious concern. And as print media is having its own problems, there is less and less space in print media devoted to books. There are fewer book reviewers. They pay less attention to anything but, you know, Harry Potter and the biggest book-selling phenomenons. But there are some pluses. I think that the internet and email have created opportunities for people to reach an audience, to market books at a cost that no one could afford 15 years ago. Harvard Bookstore sends out an email newsletter to 35,000 people every week. We could not have reached 35,000 people even a couple of times a year 15 years ago. As a buyer, I get emails from publishers from the very large to the very tiny every week telling me about breaking publicity for books that they're publishing. Those small publishers could not have afforded to reach me with that kind of news only a few years back. The phenomenon that has become known as the long tail, in which, because of the internet, there's some thought that we are less dependent on the big mega hits, and that there are lots and lots of sales to be had in this long tail. That is, smaller niche markets, interests that are not represented by the big mega hits. There are 5.6 million books listed in books in print in English, and that is up from 1.5 million in, I believe, 2004. And Amazon lists all those books. This is not great news for traditional book retailers, for bricks and mortar stores like Harvard Bookstore. But for books and for authors, that sort of availability may be a wonderful thing in the long run. There's much better distribution for small presses than there used to be. And small presses, I think, is where much of the risky writing is appearing. I can remember when I first started as a buyer, it was the week after the blizzard of 78, and a couple of guys came to my office. They were the people who went around the entire country trying to sell small press literary books, and they would come to, you know, Cambridge, and they would go to New York and Chicago and Berkeley and maybe Ann Arbor, but there weren't a lot of places they could go. One of the early things that I bought was Paul Auster's New York trilogy, which was published originally by a small press. The people from South End Press were here, and so they would come to my office. But when these people showed up, I had to place a separate order for books with each of these small publishers. And for a small independent bookstore, that was an economy that was difficult to deal with. Now there are five or six distributors of small presses, so that many more bookstores can carry small press books in an economically feasible way, because we can get them all from one source. So I think that that's a huge improvement and a big change. There's marketing money that is becoming available from outside sources. There's a new group called the Literary Ventures Fund that is picking out books that they think have literary merit, and they're putting marketing energy and money behind them. And there's some things that have real potential. I think at this point they haven't developed, or else they're developing in what seems to me the wrong way. But print on demand, in which digital files can be taken and turned into books as the demand is there, in the long run, could be a really wonderful thing and a real economic benefit to small publishers, small presses, and bookstores. And I think the nature of self-publishing is changing. It used to be that self-publishing was looked at as was looked down upon, sneered at. A bookstore would never consider carrying self-published books. And I think that's changing dramatically today because of all the things that are available on the internet, lit blogs, which can promote these kinds of books. That whole landscape is changing, and I think self-publishing in the future will become much more a reality and a real way to sell books.
Thank you, Carol. I think as people begin to arrange themselves by the mic to ask the panel questions, I just want to pick up one thing that you mentioned, which was the kind of niche marketing that's going on. And I think to my mind, that sort of niche marketing is part and parcel of people withdrawing into tinier and tinier micro identities. I only want to read something by somebody like me. You know, if I'm in a wheelchair, I only want to read other authors who are in a wheelchair. If I'm a man, I won't read women authors. You know, if I'm African American, I don't want to read Hispanic authors. And I wonder if the economics of looking and searching for those readers that has driven publishers to that niche marketing isn't driving us further and further apart as a culture, as a nation. So I don't know if anybody wants to speak to that, but it just occurred to me as you were talking from the bookseller's perspective.
This is Carol. I guess I'll jump into that. I think that's a really interesting question. I was just reading this book called The Long Tail, which as I said, as a bookseller, it's a fairly depressing book because there's not a lot of room in it for bookstores. But he talks about how culture has changed from the days in which we, you know, there was the water cooler phenomenon. Everybody watched I Love Lucy, and then everybody talked about it the next day. And that just doesn't happen anymore. And I think that you're right, and it's not just books. It's culture in general that is, I mean, I'm sure you were exaggerating on purpose, but there is the phenomenon of people looking more and more for smaller niches, and nobody watches the networks anymore. Magazine sales are down dramatically, and yet, you know, there are thousands of blogs that people read. on things that interest them. And I think you're right. And I think it's probably inevitable.
Well, the concern that I have is Salman Rushdie called literature the way that a culture has a conversation with itself. And so we're here tonight talking about where the conversation is breaking down and what, you know, what are the symptoms of that breakdown. I don't think one has to posit a conspiracy to see the collusion involved with, everybody chasing the same dollar and therefore looking for ways to stay afloat, to maximize profits, to find those readers. And then I'm concerned about the impact on writers, particularly younger writers, who are moving into that sort of landscape or environment, thinking, who do I have to be? How do I have to, to slip through this crack here? How do I have to remake myself? Which is something I think that Linda was talking about earlier. So it's all connected, but it's almost like when you get to the point where the driving marketing strategy is niche marketing, then the battle is lost already, in terms of a conversation among different parts of a culture. Well, that was a depressing idea.
Well, I don't know. I would say yes and no. This is Mark talking. On the one hand, the wonderful diversity of all these varieties of what you term niches, has great potential for a really diverse variety of voices. And so, I guess another aspect I would say is, when I am trying to market a new book of poetry, and there are, lots of new books of poetry coming out, how do I market this book? This is I'm thrilled by this writer. I think this writer is just truly exciting. Their language is unique, vibrant, formally inventive. How do you sell that to an audience? It's pretty hard. So, when I have an author who happens to be a gay Filipino Hawaiian writer, I have a little confidence that I'm going to, that I can at least market it to a certain audience, okay? And that's still going to be a poetry reading audience primarily. And so, so it works both ways, I think, So it's not all one thing, I think.
I'd like to comment on the negative side of that, since in my experience teaching, the marketing of identity has been, students have learned to do that. And the identities that they're marketing are not marketing different intellectual identities. They're all, it seems to me, it's this, whatever you want to call it, this literary hierarchy, this sense of what good literature is, which is the old, quote, timeless and universal truth of human experience, insofar as any student is able to achieve that sort of homeostasis in the work, then that work will be that work will be desired. We still don't want angry work. I'm thinking, having lived in Alaska and seen the way in which people who have things to be angry about, what they've published very often has been praised because they have surrendered their anger. They have either they have accepted that they were victims of the timeless and universal human condition, or else, I feel that what's operating in that world is the expectation that you might get to have one little angry something, but then what you're supposed to say is that you'll join the club, and the only thing really that was wrong with the bus was that you weren't on it. There's nothing really wrong with the bus. And I think it's extremely difficult. I mean, we are an anti-intellectual country. There's just, in comparison to other developed nations, we do not have analytical, rational abilities developed in us in school the way other people do. I mean, Al Gore's new book, The Assault on Reason, Harry Frankfurter's book, he's a Princeton professor of philosophy, wrote the book on bullshit. Everyone's writing about the fact that what's happened to language in this country with our elected officials is not isolated. It's not proper only to them. It's a digestion of the intellectual life that we have accepted. And when you make language the material that you market, when you make making meaning a thing that you're going to sell, when you're doing that in the Vatican of capitalism, and when this lyric triumphalism is absolutely cognate with the upward mobility that capitalism encourages us to give our lives to, then you're going to get people who are only occupying a very narrow range of the intellectual response to their lives that is possible. And the other aspect of that is the way in which identity politics and creative writing has made enemies of everyone and has punished people for attempting to write. And I was investigated for 2 years by the U.S. Department of Education Office of Civil Rights for having written a poem and published it in Alaska about the situation of Native women there and elsewhere from a left perspective, from a perspective of solidarity. And when I went to read in Mexico City a few years ago, representing the U.S. and the English language, the Native women in Central and South America embraced me and thanked me. They knew about this. But I was tenured, and I held on, but at tremendous cost to me in Alaska, because I had made myself vulnerable by writing outside my alleged identity. And that sort of, to talk about the control that exerts on everyone, I can't tell you how every student before and after knew that you had to be very careful about what you said and what you spoke about and how you spoke about it. And the safest thing was to stay as far away as possible, which is how we get to this literary quietism that is the norm in American literary life.
Thank you, Linda. You're joining us at Cambridge Forum as we continue our discussion of the American landscape, risky writing, and the forces keeping it silent, with poet, editor, and mathematician Mark Pavlik, prize-winning poet Linda McCarriston, small press editor and publisher Jill Petty, and Carol Horn, general manager of Harvard Bookstore.
Beyond the Book is an educational presentation of the not-for-profit Copyright Clearance Center, with conferences and seminars featuring leading authors and editors, publishing analysts, and information technology specialists. Beyond the Book is the premier source for knowledge on the latest business issues facing today's dynamic publishing industry, from initial research to final publication and beyond.